Sounds good.
Welcome back to another episode of the CBA's ABCs of Bow Hunting, the Colorado Bow Hunters Association Banquet Edition. I'm here with Craig Kimball. Craig, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, thanks.
It's good to see you again. It's been maybe about a year.
It has been. Maybe a little bit longer.
Yeah, it's nice to see all these familiar faces back at the banquet as well. And honestly, I like this venue a little better. I feel like we got a little more space here.
Yeah, it's a good venue. I didn't get here until about 2 o'clock this afternoon. But
I'm gonna have you bend that microphone in just for your space a little bit. Beautiful, perfect.
Okay.
So what I'd like to do here is kind of get a little bit of your history with hunting, your history with the CBA. I'll ask you some hunting stories, and we'll just kind of shoot the shit for a little bit.
All right.
So I'm curious as to how you entered the world of hunting in general. Do you have family members that hunt? What was your introduction into?
Well, I grew up in Iowa, and my dad, he wasn't really much of a big game hunter. In fact, I didn't know anything about big game hunting, but he was a pheasant hunter, quail hunter, squirrels, rabbits. He'd take me hunting, you know, bought me a .22, that type of stuff. And that's how I learned. I didn't learn until later as I was going through pictures that I saw he and my mom both had longbows.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and pictures of him shooting and my mother shooting too. And then I do remember having a little fiberglass longbow when I was growing up, and I was, you know, shooting targets on a cardboard box in the backyard and that type of stuff. And but after that, I really never I was really hunting with guns.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until a little bit later I started hunting pheasants with shotguns, that type of thing. But Iowa, and I never hunted whitetails in Iowa.
I was going to say, that's the home of the Giants.
Never hunted whitetails in Iowa. Never even thought about it. And then my wife and I moved out here to Colorado. And she started having kids. And I started... well, fortunately, it was with me. I've been married 45 years now, so there's something still there. But yeah, I started hunting deer with a rifle. A friend of mine, I even borrowed his rifle. He took me out hunting. And so I hunted rifle for 18 years, and I didn't start bow hunting until I was 45 years old. And I thought, well, you know, rifle's too easy. You know, it's just really too easy. I can, you know, 250 yards, I can take a deer. I did start, I shot a couple elk with my rifle and stuff. Open sights, by the way. But it's too easy. So I thought I'd maybe get into bow hunting. So I went up to Cabela's and in Sydney, I think it is, into their bargain cave. And I found an old wheel bow, you know, an old compound. Bought that, went out. First year, I I got a chance at a huge mule deer. I mean, he was probably 190, 200, and I had him at 25 yards. Actually, I thought it was 25 yards, and it was probably 15. I shot right through the top inch of his back, and he took out.
Colorado?
Yeah, in Colorado, down where I live, and that was in 1996, I think. And I thought, oh, how did I miss that? At that close range, you know. The next day, a guy said, I saw a huge mule deer, but he had a cut in his back and he was licking it. I thought, well, that was me yesterday. But he didn't shoot it. And then actually, that guy became a good friend of mine for years. I still know him. I mean, still, he works out in Fort Carson. And so I've known him. Through Fort Carson, so.
Let me pause you right there. I'm
sure.
Curious, between when you were a little kid and 45 years old, did you shoot a bow at all in between those two?
No.
Wow. And so was it strictly the ease or lack of closeness or difficulty that brought you into that brought the world of art? Were you thinking with hunting, like, man, I need to make this more exciting, and archery just popped into your brain?
Yeah, that's basically what it was.
Okay.
Yeah, it was like I said, it was too easy with the rifle, and I thought, gosh. And then I saw an advertisement for the Colorado State Archers Association state tournament in Manitou Springs. And Manitou Springs just up the road from us. I'll go up and watch that, and something just sparked me right there to watch all these 100 guys line up and they're all shooting. And I was kind of a, when I was growing up, it was kind of a Indian medieval type guy that liked that type of stuff. You know, and I'd have the Indian books and how they made things and did things. And so I was interested in that. And I, well, this is pretty cool. So then I got another bow, or that bow. I guess it was that bow. And then now I've got 9 bows, and you know I still have my parents' longbows.
With your hunting, was it always compound? Do you ever get into recurve at all? Or?
I have a recurve. I have actually 2 recurves, and I have my parents', like I said, longbows. But I just I don't practice enough with a longbow or a recurve to really be good at it.
Yeah.
Compound. I am still a meat hunter. I still like getting the meat, and I figure with a longbow or a recurve, I have less of a chance. So I shoot a compound.
Yeah. And at what point in your hunting archery or archery hunting career did you find the CBA? How did that come into your world?
Well, what was it? Let's see. It was in 1998. For some reason, I heard about the CBA, so I joined. And I went out hunting that fall and shot a 181.5 mule deer, my first animal with a bow.
Man.
And that got first in the 1998.
That's incredible.
Thing like this, you know.
Did you enter Pope and Young with that as well?
Yes, I did. Wow. Yeah.
That's so cool, man.
Yeah, then it got me hooked big time. The next year, I shot a little basket 8, like about this, you know. But it was still a cool thing, you know, because it was a little bit farther distance. And that first deer was quite an experience. And, you know, I didn't make a good shot on it. And actually, it was a longer story than that. It was walking 30 yards, and I didn't lead it enough. And it took off, you know, and it bedded down. Then it took off and bedded down. And it was close, getting close to the interstate. This is down by Fountain again.
Yeah.
Right. And getting close to the interstate, and I saw it, and it bedded. I got my car, drove around, and I'm sitting in my car watching it, and its head's going down, you know, it's going to die. And I just didn't think I could go just walk up and shoot it. You know, I just didn't want it. So he's going to die pretty soon. So this is dusk now.
Yeah.
Turned my lights off, waited 10 minutes, turned my lights on, and he's gone.
Oh.
He's gone. And this huge mule deer is gone. And so I searched, I found a little bit of blood. Now I searched for a couple hours. It's 9:30. I went out to, I called my friend who I taught with. I said, "You got to come and help me
track
this thing." We had, that was a school night, by the way, and he had school. We're both teachers, and we searched till 3:30 in the morning, finding little specks of blood on grass about every 10 yards. And so, as we were doing this, I put toilet paper at every spot.
Yeah.
And of course, it's pitch dark out. There's no moon or anything,
sure.
And we. You know, at 3:30, I said, "I can't do this anymore." And he wanted to go to school. So I called in sick the next morning. My wife called in sick. We went out to where we were tracking it, you know, and got to the point where he had bedded the first time when I had my lights on. Perfect line of toilet paper.
Wow.
Going right to a gate about 400 yards away.
Uh-huh.
Just straight line. I walked over to the gate and there he was. And the coyotes had eaten the back half. And the only good thing about that was that I didn't have to drag the whole animal, you know, all the way back to my car. And I got to taxidermy it, you know, and it turned out to be a pretty cool mount. So.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
It's
interesting.
So I've been talking to people all day long here, and a big theme that's been coming up with animal recovery is persistence. Is not just you'll look for an hour, you give up, and you walk away. I mean, you took off a day from work to find this.
Right, right.
And you may or not have been able to recover any meat off of that animal, and obviously that was your goal, but it's just so interesting to hear. And it makes me appreciate, because a lot of people I've been talking to have decades of hunting experience more than I do. And it's just nice to have that ingrained in my head. You know, the goal is quick, clean kill. If it dies in my eyesight, then I am ecstatic.
However, right.
I'm sure over the next 1, 10, 20, 30 years of my hunting that I'm going to have these experiences. And just hearing these things makes me think, you know, stick with it.
Yeah, you have to. I had a bear run right at me down a hill, but he didn't. He wasn't running at me, but he was running at toward me.
Yeah.
And I just ducked down. He came up over the knoll like this. I came to full draw, and he turned and started to run. Uh-huh. And I shot him. Didn't lead him again.
Yeah.
And I tracked him back and forth, not back and forth, but I tracked him, and then I lost it.
Yeah.
So I had to come back to the beginning again, 5 hours. And finally, I'm thinking, I'm going to give up. You know, I've done my due diligence, you know, and I hear some squirrels, you know, off in the distance, about 200 yards. Going, I wonder, you know, are they chattering at him? I walk over and he's leaning up against a tree.
Wow.
Yeah, but 5 hours later, you know, so again, persistence. You know, paid off, and just kind of being out there and saying, well, squirrels are, you know, they're going to be chattering at hunters maybe, but they're chattering at bears, or chattering maybe at other animals. I'll just check it out on a whim.
I'm curious, over the course of your hunting here in Colorado, or just in general, what animals have you pursued so far? We talked about mule deer, talked about a black bear.
I've shot everything except mountain goat and a mountain lion.
Any desire to go for the mountain lion?
In fact, I was just talking about there, and no. And the reason is I won't hunt with dogs.
Yeah, and finding them yourself is nearly impossible.
Right. Well, I had a friend of mine up in South Dakota. He sent me a picture. He said he was rifle hunting, of course, but he was calling coyotes, and he had a mountain lion come in, about a 200-pounder, and he shot it.
I guess that makes sense. I mean, they're smart, but it could come into a predator call. And then with black bear, do you have a technique with that? Do you have a specific way? I want to get one. I really think that they're a cool animal. I want to try how they eat. I just don't know where to start, you know.
Right.
I attack, that's where I start.
Right, right. Well, I've shot three. That one that I just mentioned, I shot my second one. This is a scary story for me, but I shot my second one. I'm hunting elk, and I like to get up on a knoll so I can see. And they travel from water up to their bedding area,
okay.
And there's a road that they'll follow. And so I'm waiting for the elk, and there's a black bear walking the road. And I got on my horse, but I ran down through the sagebrush and stuff, and I got probably 60 yards from me, just kind of turned and looked at me and jumped into the bushes. But the bushes, and there's a bank or a cliff on the other side, and those bushes come around and they come back to the road again. So he can't go up the cliff, so he's got to come around. So I ran down that way. He popped out at 40 yards. I was already drawing, and I shot, and he started to move forward, and I shot him in the back leg. Really a great hunter. I've just told you three stories where I've gut shot two animals and shot another one in the leg. And yeah, and he takes off, and I thought, God, I shot him in the back leg. Well, it hit the femoral artery.
Oh, wow.
And I tracked him for probably 100 yards, and the path of the blood trail was probably 8 inches wide. And I just, you know, just walked, and I can see him in the thicket on his belly laying there. I'm looking for breathing, nothing. I said, okay, I'm just going to knock an arrow just in case, you know. And I get in there, and I'm, from me to the wall right there, what is that, 3 yards away, 4 yards away, and it gets up on all, it gets up, and I had knocked an arrow, and I just turned and just did this. I got a compound, and I just snapshot it and took off, and it hit a little sapling right in front of me. But I ran. Well, he did the same thing. He was scared, and he ran the other way, but he ran up an oak brush, because they were about 12, 14 feet tall. And he's on a limb that's probably no taller than this ceiling right here.
Yeah.
So then I walked up and shot him again. And,
wow.
Yeah. But I was a little scared.
Yeah.
You know, because I want to get mauled, of course, but I just took off. And
so you said you hadn't shot a mountain lion. What was the other one?
Mountain goat.
Mountain goat. So you have got a sheep.
I have got a sheep. I shot that at 15 yards. I have got a mountain goat, but I shot it with a rifle.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I had it during rifle season, but I took my bow, so I had my rifle and my bow. And the opportunity came just to shoot it with a rifle, and it's above timberline, of course, you know, and I wanted to take it, so I did, and now I kind of regret it. That I wish I could have, you know, taken it with my bow.
Did you keep applying after that?
I've applied every year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely a goal. I hear guys talking about moose and sheep and goats, and I'm like, all right, if I'm in Colorado for the long term, then hopefully I'll get a shot sometime in the next decade or two. But I'm curious if you look back at any of your hunting history and there's something that sticks out to you as a major success, whether it's something you figured out, an animal you got, helping a friend get an animal.
Well, there's a lot of things. I think the first thing that comes to mind is the elk that I shot in 2011.
Why is that?
Because I only hunted an hour and a half, even though I'd scouted with my grandson, who was 8 at the time, and scouted the area. And I got up there. In fact, I guided a guy and his son over in the Sangre de Cristos for 5 days and got the son a shot at a 6x6 bull that he shot over its back. And but I didn't hunt during that time, you know. But I had a license in another area, draw area, so I'm gonna head over there. This was on a Monday. I headed over there, got there about 4:30, parked my vehicle, my camper stuff. You know, I'm just gonna head out here. I'm gonna go up the hill. I get up there and I see some tracks, fresh tracks that are going up the hill. I'm just gonna pull off to the side of this trail, sit here for a while, sit here till dusk. You know, no shooting light, and so I'm sitting there and I'm 20 yards off the trail that I come up, and up above me, I hear, you know, oh, it's about 7 o'clock. And I cow called to it, and it was probably a quarter mile away. I cow called to it, and it's closer the next time. And the last time I looked at my watch, it said 7:11. I said, well, that's lucky. Yeah. So I kept calling, getting closer, and pretty soon here comes 4 cows running down the hill into this little opening about 40 yards away, and they're looking around like, where's the cow? Where's the cow? And they head down that way. Now they're 60, 70 yards away. The bull comes down. I can see just a whale tail, because big 6x6, sure. And he's coming right toward me because
really?
He knew where the sound came from.
Oh, yeah.
And he was coming, angling, and as soon as I saw him, I drew.
Yeah.
He stopped on the trail where I had left the trail, and his left leg was forward. I'm shooting him from that side,
yep.
And his head is down, smelling.
No way.
But I was already drawn, and I shot. Sounded like I hit a tree.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, I hit a tree. How can I hit a tree? Because I was shooting through some aspens.
Sure.
And it took off. It's almost dark, and the cows are calling, but I don't hear him, so I just went back to my camper for a sleepless night. Got up in the morning, came back, found blood. All right, cool. And I see this horn 150 yards, and he's dead, like laying on his front legs, and I can't move him.
No.
I got up to him, and I mean, I can't push him over. So I went back to my friends and got a come along, and we quartered him, you know, boned him out. And
so would you like drag him to the roadway?
Well, my friend could get an ATV up there because
gotcha.
He was the ranch manager whose ranch I crossed to get to National Forest.
Nice.
And so he helped me, but the aspens were about this far apart, so it took us a long time to get the elk head down with the horns because it scored 374.
No.
Yeah, it scored 374 net and gross and 367 net, so I only lost, 6 points, 7
that's
points.
Incredible.
Yeah, he's a beast.
You have it on your wall somewhere?
Oh, I have it up at Sportsman's Warehouse. I can't get it in my house. I taxidermy it myself. I do taxidermy.
You do?
Yeah, I've done it since 2006, but I kind of sloughed off a little bit because it's time-consuming and people are wanting me to be there during hunting season to bring me their animals, and I want to be out hunting. And so I kind of, you know, I'm getting a little older, so I kind of cut back, and I only do it for friends now and stuff. But I couldn't get him in the house when I taxidermied him in my garage.
Check him out?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Man, you got to tell me which Sportsman's. We'll go check it out.
Yeah, it's in Colorado Springs.
Colorado Springs.
Yeah, yeah.
That's really cool.
Yeah, yeah. He was, it was, you know, I saw the horn sticking up. Well, that's a big one. Because I didn't see all the horns. You know, in fact, I wasn't focused on the horns. I knew it was big, but I was trying to focus on the body. And, yeah.
That's so great.
The way it turned
out,
yeah.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
So is there any, like, specific hunting tactics that you really found yourself drawn towards over the
spot
years?
And stalk.
You love it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I spot and stalk whitetails out east in open country.
Oh, really?
Yeah, in CRP fields.
Yeah.
And I've taken 5 or 6 that way. But I wrote an article for the magazine about stalking whitetails in open country. And it's a lot of fun. Kind of developed some techniques to do that. The biggest one I shot a couple years ago, I lucked into, but I sat on him for 9 hours the day before.
Really?
And couldn't get up on him. He was with a doe, locked down with a doe, you know.
Yeah.
9 hours waiting for him to do something. I'm still 100 yards away, and the doe stands up, and he gets up and goes over and mounts her and goes back down and lays down. She walks away, kind of walking up over the hill. He gets up, walks over the hill, and I don't see him again. Came back the next day. Another buck runs through this area. I said, well, I'm going to go after that one. And now the CRP is about 3.5 feet tall.
Yeah.
And this, I was watching this other buck the day before in a cut cornfield. And I'm walking to where that buck bedded because I like to watch them where they bed.
Sure.
And then figure out a way to get close to them. I walk right up to this buck that I was on the day before.
Uh-huh.
He jumps up with his doe and they run out 40 yards. I didn't have an arrow knocked. I just ducked down into the brush and knocked an arrow and stood up. And I said, that's 40. Shot him. He took off running. He went about 200 yards and fell over.
Cool.
So that, I mean, I just lucked into him.
Yeah.
You know, just lucked into him. But it was the same one. He turned out, he was gross score 158, but he, whitetail, wow. But he net scored 128.
Really?
He lost 30 inches, 30 points, because one side was bigger than the other.
Yeah.
But he was an 11-pointer, so that was okay.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been telling guys I really am interested in the Colorado whitetail. I got into whitetail hunting back in New York, and it's out of a tree stand.
Yeah.
But I think there's a lot of opportunity here, and guys really don't really think about it. You know, it seems to people are enamored with mule deer and elk and everything up in the mountains.
I haven't hunted mule deer probably for 10, 12 years now. I always apply for a tag out there, and the unit I apply for, I get it with no points. In fact, I was getting it with my second choice sometimes.
Oh, that's really cool.
And I've lucked into a rancher out there that lets me stay in his house, in the basement, of course. But the basement has a big screen TV, a pool table, 3 bedrooms, bathroom, shower, you know, all that
Nothing
kind of stuff.
It's,
I was roughing it, you know. And so, yeah, it worked out.
A little meat here and there.
Yeah, well, I cook him dinner. I go out there and I cook him dinner. They've got 4 kids now, but they had 2 at the time. And so I cook him dinner at night when I come back. And
that's
so
great.
It kind of worked out.
That.
Yeah.
While you've been hunting, I'm curious if there's any situations that you've gotten yourself into, whether you're by yourself or with friends, that just was like a little precarious, like a situation that stands out to you. Rick, storm came in, or you ended up on a cliff edge, or something like that.
Yeah, I was. I had shot. Actually, I shot 2 elk. Shot 1 elk in the morning. And the herd moved up the hillside. This is over in the sand graze. And the next morning, I get up to where I thought they were, and there's 2 bulls fighting. And they're sparring, you know, heads down. So I just walked up to 30 yards and shot the one on the right.
No way.
Yeah. And I got all that meat, and I was going to come back. And I had to get the meat back to my house, which is 3 hours away. And I came back like 3-4 days later, hoping that there was a bear on it. So I went up. Excuse me. And I was talking to a guy down there. He says, yeah, I've been watching this bear. There's a elk carcass up there. I've been watching him for the last 4 days, but I haven't seen him lately, you know. And I said, well, that's my elk carcass. I'm going to go up there and sit on this bear. And I get up there and no bear. There's only skin left. I'm thinking, okay, I'll just sit here a little bit. I see this storm coming across the valley. And it's not lightning coming down, mm-hmm. but it's lightning going across.
Yeah.
It comes right over the top of me.
No.
And I mean, I'm up probably 11,000 feet and it's cracking right above me. What took me, about an hour and a half to get up to that spot. I was down there in about 15 minutes because I was, running through scrub oak and jumping stuff and getting down there, and it's cracking up above me. I'm like, I'm not staying out in this stuff.
Yeah.
You know, lightning is pretty dangerous stuff. And
especially if you're out in the open. Yeah.
I'm just lucky it wasn't coming down to the ground.
Man, it's fascinating. You're not the only person I've talked to today who got themselves in a situation where they said, it took me X amount of time to get there, a storm rolled in, and it took me about a half the amount of time to get out.
That's right. Well, I was telling you about this elk I shot from where I camped and where I actually ended up shooting it. Took me about an hour to get up to. And then the ranch house from my friend, it was another mile down there. Mm-hmm. Well, the time that it took me to get up to where that elk was to shoot it that day,
yeah.
It only took me a half an hour to run down to his house.
Yeah.
I was in pretty good shape back then because I ran cross country.
Sure.
And I'm motivated. Right. Adrenaline was pumping, you know. So,
yeah.
But yeah, it's amazing what you can do when you're excited.
Surreal.
Yeah.
That's wild. So I'm curious in your time with the CBA, how you've seen it change, how you've seen it grow. I know that you and Gerald kind of stepped in a few years ago to this more top leadership position, and now allowing Henry and some other guys to kind of take over those items. I'm, you know, as a newer member, I've only been in the CBA for a little over a year now. Want to hear a little bit of your perspective on what you've seen, how you feel about it.
Well, I got on the board in 2003. And I got off it in 2021, so I was on it for 18 years.
Appreciate
so
that.
I saw a lot of things happening and gained a lot of experience as to how things work, you know, those types of things. But then, it starts to get a little tougher to do the things after 21 years. And Gerald felt the same way. I mean, we were both 71 years old. And so we decided to stay on another year just to kind of see this transition through, because the guys came on, they wanted to do new magazine, get into the podcast stuff and all that type of thing, and we just need to stay on. And because I looked at the number of people on the board at the time, and there's usually 24 members, and I'm looking at the board and like 17 of them have only been there less than 5 years.
Right.
Henry was the one that had been there the longest.
Yeah.
And the other people had come on and had no experience.
History, yeah.
Yeah, history of it. And that's kind of tough, So we volunteered to stay on, kind of see it in through this transition period.
Yeah.
There's still some things that I think need to be worked on,
sure.
And just looking at the banquet, that type of thing, some things that were traditional in the way you do things that maybe get you some more money. But that's just a learning situation. We had to learn it too.
Right.
And I was myself and Kurt Hovenek, who is has helped with the banquets for years now and getting donations and stuff. We kind of said, okay, let's do our thing here and start getting some more donations and stuff so the banquet can be more successful. So,
yeah.
I contact a lot of the hunts that we've had in the past couple of years, and they all wanted to donate again. I contacted Quiet Cat and got the bike that's out there.
They donated a bike this week.
Well, they didn't donate it, but they gave us a good discount on it.
Ah, cool.
So, we bought that, and we're going to raffle it off, that type of thing. Just some things to generate some money. I contacted 26 whiskey distilleries along the Front Range to see if I could get donations, and I think four of them responded. And the nice thing about that whiskey package that's out there, that barrel goes with it.
Really?
Yes, goes with it. But anyway.
That's cool.
But yeah, the change that I've seen, the magazine is great. The membership is growing. Gerald and I are not, we are technologically hampered a little bit, and all these guys coming in that know how to do this, know how to do that. The last meeting we were in where we weren't on the board, it was January, we decided to come back and just check on the thing. And guys are talking, hey, I'll do a Google's doc to you, and I'll do this and that. I look over at Gerald, I say, what's a Google Doc? You know, I mean, I'm sure you know what it is, but, sure. You know, us old guys, you know, I got to have my grandkids show me how to use my cell phone, you know, do all those things on it. I'm getting better at it, but still, you know.
Well, I think the key thing that I'm seeing is that you guys aren't resisting it, right? A lot of guys who have been around and things have been successful, they don't want to change with the times. And you guys have been very open to that. And I think it takes, as Taryn telling Gerald this as well, is it takes a certain leadership quality to relinquish control and trust that your baby, this thing that you've been a part of, that you care about so much, is in good hands.
Right.
You can shepherd it there, right? You can keep your thumb to the pulse. You have the ear of the people who matter. But at the same time, allowing me, a stranger who has very little bow hunting experience, to tell you, hey, a podcast is a good idea for us, and then we spend all the money on the equipment. I appreciate the trust there, and I also hope that I can help honor those historic legacies that we have. And it's a big reason why I want to talk to you guys, is because I want to hear where this stuff came from. I mean, it's fascinating to me that something that I'm so passionate about, and only been passionate about for 4 or 5 years, guys have been passionate about since the 50s and the 60s.
Right.
And
right.
Built the season dates and built the season structure. I really appreciate, one, that you're willing to stay on board and not just let it go to the wayside, but also allow some change to happen.
Well, I think the thing that motivated me most to be a part of it and try to let that happen was that our membership was fairly stagnant.
Yeah.
And that we were losing membership, not losing membership. Well, yeah, it was going down somewhat, but we weren't drawing in a lot of young people.
Right.
And, you know, we have all the old people we know, and they're all still passionate about it, but we're not going to be the future of the Bow Hunters Association. It's the younger people that are going to be the future of it. And so allowing these young people to take the reins and make these changes, I mean, it was a no-brainer. You have to do it, otherwise we're going to die.
Yeah.
You know, and that's
asking a lot of people. I mean, $30 a year, you get 6 publications.
Oh my
God. You get access to the online, the digital copies. You have access to all these community members with all this history. The podcast is free up front, but we have the banquet, we have the shoots, we have meetups and things of that nature. And it's just really interesting to me that for such a low cost, how much you really can get in one of the states that offers the best hunting opportunities for general public out in the, you know, lower 48. It's pretty wild.
It's amazing to me that, or why not every bow hunter in the state is a member.
Yeah.
You know, for what we do for bow hunting and how long we've been doing it, why isn't everybody a member of the CBA? It's right. Just why wouldn't you be? For $30, you can't go out to McDonald's anymore for $30 for two people.
But also the amount of money, like in modern times, the amount of money it takes to be a bow hunter, especially a compound bow hunter, is you're spending that on a single arrow setup could be $50, $60, $70. So break an arrow in half and give half of it to the CBA.
But I agree.
Encourage people to join. And so just a little plug here is if you go to coloradobowhunting.org, there's a membership portal where you can join $30 a year. There's lifetime memberships available as well. You get the publication and you get access to all these people who are dedicated to this. And even if you bow hunt in Colorado once, you're willing to spend, especially as an out-of-state resident, $700-$800 for a tag to bow hunt here. I mean, filling up your car costs a ton of money today. So in order to support us, I really encourage people out there to join the CBA.
Well, certainly. Years ago, I wrote an article that was published in the magazine, and I think they still use the letter today, because I was getting down in my area, which was the East region, I was getting people, well, all you want is our money.
Right.
Why should I join? I said, well, you get magazines, but you know, we represent you in front of the legislature and the liaison, but what do I get for my money? All you want is the money. And I wrote this letter and I said, yes, we want your money. How do you think we operate?
Right.
You know, it's just not, we're not paying it out of our own pockets. How do you think we operate? We pay, at that time, we paid a lobbyist.
Yeah.
It takes gas money. It takes this, that, to do all.
Getting a salary.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, we need your money. This is what.
501c3, so it's, yeah. It's legit. And man, just the amount of work that like Wes Mendez does on the legislative side, that alone.
Right.
This year with Hunter's Orange, with the children's education, hunters' education in schools, the knocking down the potential mountain lion ban. In the past few months, we've done a ton. And it's not that we're given all the credit. We don't deserve all the credit. However, us, along with various organizations, whether it's Ducks Unlimited or Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, even the Cattlemen's Association that we're starting to kind of partner with on some of these things. I know that they're with us on wolves and other items.
Right.
It's it takes a big community, and we have to continue to build that community in order to have a voice, a unified front. Whether you shoot fixed blades and I shoot mechanicals, we can talk about that behind closed doors.
It doesn't matter. When I first got on the board, there was some talk about people not joining the CBA because, well, it's all traditional bow hunters.
Right.
Or the whole board is traditional bow hunters.
Right.
Not so. No. A lot of them shoot compounds. I mean, especially now.
Sure.
But back then it was, oh, they're all traditional. It's all front range stuff. Why should we join over in the Western Slope? Those types of things. And that's the farthest from the truth. You know, we're all in it for bow hunters. It doesn't matter what you're shooting. And there's some people that still won't join because they still believe that.
Yeah.
And we can't get that stigma out of their mind. You know, it just, but, you know, we can't waste our time on those people. We got to draw on the other people that understand what we do.
100%. My goal with this is kind of, Henry and I went out to lunch this week. He's currently the chairman of the CBA. He and I were talking about the various angles we could take with the podcast, and I kind of wanted to hit it from three different fronts. I want to hear from the guys who built this organization, who made Colorado bow hunting what it is and how it is, and appreciate it, seen it change, have won and lost some battles with CPW and the legislative branch of our state government. And that's a huge part for me. I want to talk to the new guys who are getting stuff done, who are going after the Big Eight, who are finding ways to be successful, even though we have a ton of hunters and overcrowded trailheads and what have you, all the modern problems we have, there's still guys who are successful every year. And I want to hear about what their tactics are and what they're doing. And then the last thing that Henry and I are talking about is I want to talk to the CPW. I want to talk to all the regional directors, hear about how wildlife's doing in their areas, what they feel hunters could do better and worse, and just how we can be a source of like unified Colorado hunting information. I want rifle hunters to join the CBA just because they know that we're an organization that's doing good for wildlife, that's doing good for hunting in Colorado.
Right, yeah.
We all own rifles. We all rifle hunt
for the most part.
No one hates that. So
I'm also on the board for Safari Club International at our local chapter down in Colorado Springs. And I was asking this SCI to donate some money to the CBA for what we do and stuff. And one guy made a comment who really doesn't know anything about the CBA. Well, why should we give money to our competitor? And I said, how are we competing?
What are we taking from you?
How are we competing? He said, well, membership. And I was like dumbfounded and I couldn't say anything. And Brett Axton, who's our president down there, he said, no. He said, no. CBA is at every legislative event up in Denver, they're at the forefront of sportsmen's organizations that are fighting for hunting rights.
Yeah.
They're at everything. They're one of the few organizations that are at everything.
Yeah.
And the other guy's going, oh, I didn't know that, you know?
And I think that's a big part of it, is the education part. And it's kind of why I wanted to keep this not behind a paywall, is because you don't get information out there that you don't want to preach to the choir, right? I'd much rather have people get their eyes open to what we do and what we are attempting to do. And it is really interesting to hear people kind of have that perspective of you're my competitor, or what are you doing for me? And it's not that we're going to save hunting or save modern hunting. However, along with your efforts, along with everybody else's efforts, other state organizations. A friend of mine was talking about a kids' camp in Maine that has an archery program, and they're looking for some equipment. And he was asking me, he's like, hey, do you know any guys that can do some stuff? And I was like, I could talk to the CBA, but shipping old targets halfway across the United States probably isn't the answer here.
No.
However, check out the Maine Bow Hunters Association. Check out the Massachusetts Bow Hunters Association.
Yeah.
Every state has these things, and I don't think that they're our competitors. No one's trying to take money away from you. It's just that whenever I think the greatest thing that's come online lately is this Howl for Wildlife. Have you been paying attention to this?
I have not, no.
So
not lately.
basically, there's this organization, I forget what it stands for, H-O-W-L, and what they've been able to do is collect emails from people across the whole country, really across the world, but we're focused on the United States, and say, hey, Louisiana's trying to ban pig hunting, or Colorado has this Hunter Orange bill. Sign this email. Your email will go to all the state legislators, and now these legislators are getting thousands, tens of thousands of messages from hunters all across the place. And for me, I may never hunt in Alaska, but I want to defend the right to hunt in Alaska
sure.
until the day I die. And so I really think that with modern technology, with the internet, and with this global connectivity, we really can have each other's back. And man, again, $30. I waste $30 weekly on something I probably shouldn't have bought on Amazon or whatever it
might be. Starbucks.
Exactly. So
I agree.
I think it's really easy to have an impact here. And you can spend $30 on the CBA and then know that your voice is being protected and heard. And whether it's a big issue or a minor issue and you have a disagreement, you can let us know. You can go email the chairman of the board or whoever, the head of the liaison. You could talk to me. Come on the podcast. Tell me why you're opposed to something. But just in general, if you have a unified force of people behind you that kind of have your back out here.
Yeah, if you look at all the other organizations, you got. I think you got backcountry anglers.
PHA, Backcountry Hunters and Anglers.
Yeah, you have that in Colorado, Colorado Bow Hunters Association, but then you have Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, which is a national organization. You got SCI, which is a national organization, National Wild Turkey Federation, National Organization, Ducks Unlimited, blah, blah, blah. You know, they all have a large national or even worldwide organization that they can bring stuff into, you know, where we have the Colorado Bowhunters Association,
right?
And so we have to rely on people in Colorado, basically. And we have a lot. We have about 250 to 300 out of state members, but we have to rely on that type of thing to fund what we do, to try and help what we do. You know, as far as membership is concerned,
It's fascinating too because I think there's somewhere around over the entire season structure, all animals, all weapons, about 200,000 hunters that come into Colorado every year, and so. Just to think about that, we have 200 out-of-state members is almost like a slap in the face a little bit, you know, and I'm not mad at anybody. However, if you're willing to spend, take the PTO, get a hotel room, buy the tag, come with your buddies, do all this stuff, you're going to spend more at the gas station on junk food than you would on a CBA membership. So, like, I really, really hope anybody that comes across this just kind of recognizes that. And, you know, the $30 that might not mean too much to you means a ton to us.
Well, in other organizations, the point I was going to make is that their fees are higher.
Yeah,
they're much higher. You know, I joined SCI. It was $100.
Yeah,
and you know we're right now at 30, which I think could be right. We've been at 30 for 15 years.
Right.
Never raised it, and now we're at the point where, you know, I think we probably need to do that. But still, if we even raise it to $40. I mean, very affordable. Yeah,
you're getting the actual physical magazine too.
Yeah,
so it's very interesting to me.
Yeah.
To kind of pivot back to hunting before I let you go here, I like to ask this question to people: is there anything in your hunting history that you wish you were able to, that you wish you learned earlier, that you could go back and whisper in your 20-year-old ear or 45-year-old ear, and you know?
Yeah, probably practice more.
Really.
Yeah, practice more. I mean, I used to shoot a lot.
Yeah.
Shoot a lot, and I've gotten to the point now where I'll practice a little bit right before the season. You know, I'm pretty confident in what I do anyway, but you still want to practice and practice and practice and practice. When I was first starting out, those were stories that I told you where I'd wounded the animals. Those were right in like the first 5 years. The one deer was later in my bow hunting career, but yeah, practice, you know, learn about the animal, you know, there's learn about tracking. Yeah. You know, we talked about that before. Become a student of the game. You know, I'm a track coach, and I coach the shot and discus, which are very technical events. And get kids coming in and they haven't a clue, and I said, you've got to be a student of the game. You've got to look at YouTube. You've got to look at all these things that you have available to you now that we never had, because I've been coaching track for 49 years now. You never had those things. Look at, watch people. Become a student. Watch kids when they're throwing, you know. And it's the same thing for bow hunting. watch other people, become a student of the game, learn how to do all those things, because one day you're going to need it. One day you're going to need to do all these things, yeah. You know, or be able to do it.
And I think the more things, I love that advice, because the more you practice, the more the practice becomes second nature. And then when game time counts, the less you're thinking about.
Right.
You know, the more things that are rote, the more things that are just in your back pocket. And if you're fumbling with your rangefinder and trying to set your pin and you're worried about how your broadhead's going to go and how you knock the arrow, if that doesn't feel just natural, 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 then your chances of focusing on the animal, focusing on the kill shot are, you know, you can only be so focused in the moment. So where you take that attention and how you focus it matters, I think, practice.
I think shooting 3D animals without a rangefinder is a necessary thing, because I have shot more animals at longer range not using my rangefinder.
Really?
than using rangefinder. It's just, you know, just that's 40, that's 60, that's 50, whatever, that's 35, and just trust my gut and shoot it. You know, I was hunting with my grandson, I told you, or I took him hunting, hunting whitetails, and we found this bedded buck in a cut cornfield, and I cut around. He stayed in the row where he could watch him. I cut around, got downwind. Of course, I couldn't see the dang thing in the cut corn, and it jumps up. I just drew, and whitetails never stop. You know, they take off, and he stops. And I'm already drawing. I said, that's 60 yards. And I shot, and I don't know whether I hit him or not, but I noticed a little spot on the side of his, I mean, right there, you know, right where you should hit him. And he went about 150 yards down. I drilled him right there. But it was just a natural thing. Like you say, if you practice enough, you know, you just, that's 60, or, you know, it becomes automatic, you know. So I'm not bragging. I'm just saying
no.
It was probably a lucky shot, but it was.
There was some educated guess there, right?
Yeah, for sure.
One thing I've started to do is, as I approach a target, before I pull that rangefinder out, say it out loud.
Oh, yeah.
What you think it's going to be, and pull it up. And sometimes you're way off, but also when you're on the same range every day, whether it's a 3D target or a bullseye, and you have those other targets to in your peripheral vision of that's 20, 30, 40, 50, okay. When you go out in the woods, go stare at an aspen and tell me how far away that aspen tree is, because it is different, you know?
It is completely different.
And whether it's 150 yards away or 50 yards away, guess. Take a guess. Not that you'd want to blind shoot at those numbers, but just calibrate yourself. Whenever you enter a new environment, I find that sometimes if I'm in super steep mountainous terrain, my gauge is very different than I'm out in, you know, the plains or whatever it might be. So
yeah, I was elk hunting, and I had an elk down below me. I couldn't see him, but I was calling to him, and he was calling back. I'm thinking, he's going to come up here. I better range some stuff. So I got my rangefinder. Like you said, it's different when you're in the woods, you know. And I'm thinking, that tree is 35 yards. Rangefinder up is 21. No, 21. It can't be. It's 35 yards. It's 21. There's no way. The bull is right here.
Yeah.
He just come up the hill, and he's just coming at me 10 yards away. I don't have my arrow on my bow, nothing, you know. And he just kind of looks at me, and I go, hi, and it takes off the other way. But I was so enamored with, you know, my rangefinder's off. Instead of trusting it type of thing, I would have been paying attention to this thing over here. Yeah. But you got to get out there and do those types of things. Otherwise, you know, you're going to increase your chances of success.
Kurt, I really appreciate you coming on here. I appreciate all the work, all the years of the CBA, all the effort you've put in and how you helped make this banquet what it is. And just give me some of your time today, man. I mean, we could talk for hours about hunting and bow hunting. But we met about a year ago, and I've just always appreciated your attitude as well as your dedication.
Thank you. I appreciate it a lot.
Of course. Yeah. Well, we'll have to do this again, and let's go eat some food.
I'm up for that. All right. Thanks.